There is a new Asset Capitalist podcast today. It's very exciting. I'm only doing these things now as I'm pursuing passion. I'm doing it because I am in the company of Tom Morgan. And Tom has given everything up. This is, well, Monday was day one. This is day three of a new journey. Maybe like me, he is pursuing the fool's journey. I'm sure he is, actually. Not many of us are called to that path, that precarious path. But I think Tom might be one. But Tom, a veteran of the City of London, the investment banks, Wall Street, many years, Sapient Capital, amongst others. And those who follow me on Twitter, there was a Friday night. I had been drinking tequila, and I stumbled upon Tom's wonderful, I think, 5-minute presentation at the Ira Sohn conference in New York. And he's here because it was fantastic. I thought I was taking a lone path, but Tom's here to actually help me on the mission of Asset Capitalism, to tell you that if you want to see the future, you can't be a suit. You got to be loose and creative. And that's what we're going to spend the next hour or so in meandering conversations, pursuing curiosity and everything else. So as a capitalist, me, shut up. Tom, welcome to the show and thank you so much.
Thanks for having me, man. It's a real privilege.
Privilege, a privilege. We're all privileged. Where did you get the insight? Like, so I imagine, like most of us, I'm discovering that there's more than one journey. And there are pivot points, and I can point to remarkable pivot points. And people ask me for explanation because my life changed. The course of my life changed. And the word that I come back to is serendipity. But one also has to take ownership of it. And I think it's all about the life force and the energy that you put out there, that it bounces off the universe and comes back to you. And I think that's my description of serendipity. But I think, I mean, I've got a memoir coming out at the end of the summer, and I write about my pivot points a lot. So the audience know my pivot points. Am I right? Can you think of those moments?
Yeah, very clearly, because they're characteristically bonkers. I was in the city and on Wall Street for about 15 years. And it wasn't the old cliche of like, I always knew I was in the wrong job. I really enjoyed the first 10, 11 years of it. People were actually pretty cool. Everyone was kind of intellectually hungry. It's a very dynamic job. But the incremental information value, I was a research sales guy. So like the information value of one of those reports just basically dwindled to zero. And so I felt I was just like wasting my clients' time. And I really liked my clients. They were mostly like really good people. Then it became a cliche, which was like I was trapped by a bunch of money and the requirements of living in Manhattan and a nice big MD title and all of that stuff, right? And so my body and my brain started breaking down. I spent 2 years in a room at an investment bank, which counter to most people's perceptions, there was nothing really going on in that room. We didn't really have much product to sell, and people were kind of just riding it out. And that toxicity started messing with me until one day I had a spontaneous spiritual awakening stroke psychotic break sitting at my desk on a trading floor. Went, you know, pretty nuts and became insufferably spiritual for about 2 months. Suddenly one night basically descended into a dark night of the soul, and I spent 2 years there, quit my job in finance, panicked back into a job in selling credit card data to hedge funds for a year, which nearly killed me, quite literally. I jettisoned finance altogether and was like, this is all meaningless crap. And I tried to be a hospice worker, went to school for social work, tried to basically put it all behind me and aggressively pursue quote unquote meaning. Everything I tried failed, like catastrophically and quickly, until eventually I became completely immobile as a human being, got bailed out by intravenous ketamine exactly at the start of the pandemic, used 11 months after the pandemic to rebuild my psyche and literally learn how to speak again, because I couldn't articulate myself. And I started writing, and I wrote a piece that synthesized the stuff that maybe drew you to me with finance, and then put it out to my old finance audience. And one of the founders of Sapient Capital, a guy called Tom Pence, read it and was like, there's something in here that's weird and amazing and kind of different. And people will read it. And in a world that's full of just fucking dross, right? Like, it was at least differentiated. I'm not saying it was special, but it started off as really bad writing, I think. But it was 80% about wealth management. And then within the last few months, it basically went to like 0% wealth management, at which point I was like, all right, it's time for me to go. I feel like I am so passionate about the way the world is going. You know, like when you talk about the ability to see the future, that's what I'm leaning into really fully now. But that's sort of the arc of my history, with a lot of turning points, as you can tell.
Yeah. And so when was that, which year was that moment of the kind of breakdown, the rejection of that life?
The spiritual awakening moment was October 2017. And then the descent was Boxing Day 2017. And then basically I wandered the darkness for 18 and 19 and a bit into 20.
And what was going on? I don't wish to pry, but like...
Oh, no, of course. Yeah. Everything's on the table.
Relationships, yeah. And all that as well.
Oh, it's catastrophic. You know, I became a dead-eyed freak, completely unable to access the world, like completely abstracted into my own, you know, left hemisphere, as it were. But also the US, you know, mental health establishment had basically said that I was now in symptom management for the rest of my life and wasn't going to get better. And that there isn't this kind of archetypal death and rebirth that every other culture in human history has talked about. So you just got to get through it. So my wife was told I wasn't going to get better. I believed I wasn't going to get better. And I'm now considerably better than I was even before I went into it, but there was this sense of like total nihilism. My wife stayed with me because she's incredible, but she had no expectation of me actually getting better. I had a kid for a year of it, but had no ability to have any contact with him whatsoever because I was so abstracted. There's a certain state of mind when you get stuck in infinite loops in your own head. You cannot think about other people, right? Like your brain is keeping you so busy that you can't perspective take and you can't put yourself in other people's shoes. And whilst mine was an extreme example, I see a lot of guys of 36 to 55 that get caught in these transition phases that take about 3 years in my experience. And most partners and professions have the patience for maybe 3 months. But like, our culture has forgotten that there's a stage that every other culture understood where you would move from a caterpillar to a butterfly. And now instead we just make fatter caterpillars, or if you're a butterfly that's dissolving itself, you feel like you've gone mad. So we've rejected both of those systems.
Mm. It's funny because you know, we're recording this on Wednesday. We had the CPI bomb and we've just seen explosive pyrotechnics out of the currency market. The Asian currencies, the Japanese yen, is moving lower. But it's also the first day of, because every day is the first day of your new life. I am now, I think I've been divorced for a while, but since November, but all of the bureaucracy of the transfer, of all the grotesque things, it's all done. And today is the day, you know. And I wasn't fortunate enough to keep the lifetime partner. And actually, I think it allows me to bring up a word, a desperately toxic word. And if people are listening and they recognize this word, we're here to help you. If you're using the word shame, if shame is in your lexicon, we got to talk, because shame is the lowest state of being and it will take you down. And for me, so, I mean, like, obviously we seek wisdom and we go deep and we go within ourselves and we contemplate. And I came to realize that I'd fallen out of love with my life partner. And I had annoyance with that because I kind of attempt the high wire act of seeing the future. And so I get, you know, I get the you know, the Buddha teachings, the impermanence, the joy, the incredible mystique of the impermanence of everything, the impermanence of life. And yet I fell sucker, you know, to that, you know, to the religious ceremony, you know, to death do you part, which is preposterous. So I had, of course, a million distractions in my head as I was pursuing curiosity. And then this veil came down, which was me losing love, but not having the emotional bandwidth to actually recognize it. And the person on the other side remained wonderful and generous and beautiful. It was my, you know, I'm presently lowering the water level in the swimming pool here. Just now we're repairing high-end problems. We're repairing some of the swimming pool tiles. But, you know, my level came down and I was full of shame. I was full of shame that I couldn't love this person back in the manner that I had. And that persisted for 5 or 6 years. And that was the toxicity, which was on me, where she eventually had to come back and say, honey, you know, we're over. You know, so if anyone's out there, resist shame. I shouldn't have had shame. I should have had the wisdom to say, this is just, everything comes to an end one way or another, you know? So I was listening to you with that. Let's be provocative. So you had the ketamine treatment. Can I tell you a story I should not be telling?
Yeah, that's the best kind.
So my birthday is on the 16th of March, and I had a bit of a rock star party in St. Bart's. My parties are becoming legendary. And I've got a VIP suite upstairs away from the mad throng. And there's this billionaire guy, and he puts down like ketamine lines on my table. I'm like, oh, what's happening? I've never done that. And I said, oh, no, it's cool. It's cool. And it was stupidly, and people, children, if you're listening, never take drugs. Really bad idea. And it was just monstrous. And so I descended into the K-hole. And again, if I could do an educational moment, there's nothing glamorous and there's nothing fun about it. You know? And your treatment would have been on tiny micro amounts, and that's where we should explore it. Never find yourself in a K-hole. There were five of us, and we all came down I had to sit on the floor. there was a kind of, there was a belonging in that grouping, but I was paralyzed and gripped for 45 minutes. So on the whole drug thing, I'm sure you're like me. I like what's going on inside here. I really like my mind. And I'm not looking for an invasion of other forces to subdue me or to bring it down. All I seek is just further looseness and articulation. I want to be a functioning person. And so I clearly failed there. But I had an opening about a year ago. I met a remarkable individual who'd actually been an Olympic champion twice over. And he taught me a preposterously simple breathing exercise, which just literally blew my mind. And his argument was, and I'm kind of, it's a cute narrative, but kind of goes back to the Egyptians. I don't know if you've studied any of that era. And then there's the mystique of why did they burn the Library of Babylon? And the secrets. And of course, we had crusaders. We had your Western empires, empire builders. Why did they go there first? And the notion is that And again, with deity and religion and spirituality, which I think comes into our conversations, that going that far back, there was a recognition that the deity, the God, is actually within all of us, that we're all gods. But if you're building the British Empire, the Roman Empire, if you're building a Pax Americana, what do you need? You need worker ants or worker bees and just one queen. And so you actually have to close off access to the deity within the mind. And so he taught me a technique which then blew out that circuit breaker, and then you become a god. And I feel that's kind of where I'm pushing. And so the ketamine was just a really kind of awful detour, but just the microdosing on the mushrooms is opening that, because he was saying to me that, and it sounds like you were there like to 17 or whatever, very focused, ambitious, it's trying to attain targets, but kind of rigid and closed and close to the joys of life. And I think that's what probably built the brittleness, which then broke within you. So I don't know.
I mean, just so much resonance and so many things to say. You know, I've always, evil is the absence of something. It's a falling away from goodness, right? It's, and that shame, that's the feeling of shame, is that you're unworthy and you're separated, you're disconnected from something. You know, that falling away from quote unquote God. And I feel that as an intellectually abstracted British guy from like an equally abstracted lineage, right? Like I jumped through all the hoops and got all the right educational attainment, but I was very separated from the world, had no access to intuition. And I believe that I was sent into the dark night of the soul through my decision to have a son, that there was something in me that knew that if you remain emotionally distant from the world, you will fuck this kid up. And then I had 6 ketamine infusions. They were all delightful fun, but nothing happened. And they said, we'll give you 2 more and then we'll give you electroshock therapy, you know, the hard drive wipe. Right. And for whatever reason, I went into the final session and I had a hellish vision regarding my son. I cried for 4 hours afterwards. And then like within a week, my wife said she could see light in my eyes again. And I suddenly gained this intuitive sensitivity for the world. And everything I read after that, I was able to orient to the fact that it might be true. And that sense has only got better. That was the first time I found Ian McGilchrist. And I realized that, to your point about, you know, Egypt and the sages, now all of these guys went to Eleusis for like 2,000 years and they were given the psychedelic induced death and rebirth experience. But the point of it was to basically disable the ego so that those hidden forces that are incredibly real but had to be initiated can work through us, right? Like, you don't want people becoming gods with no idea how to handle that power and thinking they are bigger than gods or thinking they are gods themselves. This is the ability to co-create using those forces, very much surrendering to them. But that process breaks your ego down. But on the other side of it, it's just a much more relaxing world because you can follow your curiosity with the quote unquote faith that it's going to take you into a benign direction. Not always, but a lot of the time.
Yeah. What is your understanding? What is death of ego? I mean, maybe it can mean many things, but for you.
I think, like, you know, I'd like everything that I say to come with a caveat that I have no idea what I'm talking about. But very early on in my journey, I actually tried to kill my ego and I succeeded for a few days and I basically dwindled into nothing. And it made me realize there's this really famous stroke, this woman called Jill Bolte Taylor, who was a neuroanatomist, who funnily enough also had like a golf ball sized hemorrhage in her brain's left hemisphere. And she recounts being in the shower and basically she achieves nirvana. She sees the oneness and connected of everything. And it's this blissful feeling because she's kind of tapped into the mainframe. But then she goes to call an ambulance because she realizes she's having a stroke and she can't use a telephone because she can't recognize numbers. And I think that little anecdote tells you everything you need to know, which is, yes, have this spiritual connectedness to the world. But if you have no ego, there's no agency. You can't move in the world. You can't act in the world. So, like, you may need this temporary switch of the locus of control from your left hemisphere ego to the right hemispheric flow. But if you then don't have an ego, you basically become like a spiritual cabbage who sits there in an ashram chasing states rather than changing the world, right? Like it's not enough, in my opinion, for the crisis that we're in right now, that a lot of people just get very interested in what state of nirvana they can achieve with their own mind, and they don't get interested in how to achieve agency. And actually, I think the biggest failing of the spiritual industrial complex is that the purpose of this entire journey is to show people what they're in service of, to show people what they need to co-create. The last thing I'll say is one of the finest discoveries really since McGilchrist for me is this British classicist called Peter Kingsley. And he's still alive, and I think he's a living prophet in terms of his ability to speak the truth. And he basically talks about this corrupting influence of Eastern spirituality, where it's like the point of spirituality from the shaman downwards has always been to work out what you're supposed to do to help the whole tribe. Whereas now we've made it about climbing a hierarchy so I can just say I'm more enlightened than you. Right. But that service is the prize. And that's what hasn't been offered to anyone, because you have to use words like service. And that sounds like a shit deal, except when you realize that when you find the thing that perfectly meshes what only you can do with what the world needs, that's the best possible existence, because you're really enjoying stuff and it's meaningful for everyone else.
What happened with the lady with the brain tumor or whatever, and she couldn't read the numbers? How did she get I guess 999, I guess.
Yeah. I think she eventually dialed 911, or she dialed a friend on speed dial, maybe. She ended up in hospital, really long recovery. And then she wrote a book about it and gave a TED talk, I think the third most viewed TED talk of all time. And funny enough, the same happened to a Scots lady in one of the most interesting articles I've ever read, called What My Stroke Taught Me. And she was in Edinburgh singing karaoke, and one day she went down with a left hemispheric stroke. And she described how she could just sit in the hospital bed and watch a tree for hours, because she was just so at one with everything. But she lost the use of language. Her family were freaking out. She was totally disconnected from them and blissy, right? But her family were freaking out because she had to learn how to speak again. So that's this dynamic for all these people like Bolte Taylor and Lauren Marks was the Scottish lady's name, where basically you get this sense of connectivity, but you lose your ability to act in the world, like in a nice kind of left hemispheric way.
Mm. And because you said the infinite loop, I've got a wonderfully close, really, really close friend who wrote a rock album last year. And he's, again, he's pivoting, he's very creative, and he's pivoted into this kind of writing music. And music is that infinite loop. It's just, it's without bounds. And I'm kind of losing him. He's becoming, again, he's blissful, but unattainable. And the not the friendship suffering, it's just that, like the parents with the lady who'd lost, the power to communicate back. They're there. They seem so happy, but they're distant. And I guess we're trying to find, the crossroads where we can be blissful, but,
But I've got to go a bit conceptual for a second, and this is a hard thing to understand, but it's really, really worth it. So, the thing I couldn't say in the speech at Sohn, because it's just too unwieldy, but I think it's true, is that you and I were probably taught at school that the universe was an indifferent box where everything was kind of trial and error, and then we're all going to die in the heat death of the universe. And just over the last couple of decades, that's now completely thrown into question. And actually what seems to be like the way things are trending is that the universe trends towards complexity, which look outside, right? Look outside, even look over the last 20 years, everything is obviously trending towards more greater and greater complexity, but you then need a definition of complexity. And this is the bit where it gets a bit hard to put in your brain, because it's almost a paradox. But something that's complex has lots and lots of highly differentiated parts, but that are all completely integrated into the whole. So your body, you and I could not name the number of different parts in our own body. I have any tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of different white blood cells and all of this stuff, all completely integrated into you, right? Seamlessly integrated. So you are both highly differentiated parts and highly integrated. Now, this is where the cool bit comes in. If the universe trends towards complexity, your role in it is to become the most Hugh that you can be, the most differentiated into your gifts that you can be, but while also staying integrated into the whole. So your buddy that's lost himself, he may not be integrated. And that second bit is so stigmatized by Western civilization because it requires a relationship with your environment. Let me give you a specific example. I believe the number one signal that what you're doing, your flow is integrated, is it's greeted with synchronicities, which is a meaningful coincidence, right? So you do something, you offer your little creative sacrifice into the world, bang, coincidence, bang, coincidence, bang, coincidence, right? That's the universe or your environment, whatever you want to call it, whatever shitty word you want to use. That's it telling you, yes, more of that, please. And you can actually navigate your life according to those synchronicities, right? Like, I decided to leave my job formally about a month ago. And then almost exactly concurrently with that, I got the Sewn invite. And then I did something I really, really believed in terms of that Sewn speech. And I got, I'm currently, you know, 300,000 views or whatever it is. Like, it's a breakout moment for me. But only because I decided to take a leap out of something very comfortable and to do that through a synthesis act that really meant a huge amount to me. And I really enjoyed doing it, even though it was one of the hardest things I've ever done. It was 10 years work into 5 minutes, which actually also ended up producing perfect viral content, which wasn't intended either, right? Like a 5 minute speech is going to go more viral than a 20 minute one.
And you were a bit nervous, a bit kind of
super nervous, man. Like, everyone was like, what are you doing on stage at Sewn? Like genuinely, it was like the weirdest thing. No one can understand it. Like, it was just a room full of stock pitch after stock pitch, and it was Einhorn and all those guys. And then it was like, Tom's gonna get up and talk about curiosity. What the fuck is going on? And you know what? Like, whatever. Like, seems like this is shame, like, to use your word, this shame that, like, everyone like came up to, well, not everyone, but a bunch of people came up to me from like major financial institutions afterwards and were like, we're so interested in this and we can't tell anyone about it. And like, I get 15 DMs a week from people who work like in hedge funds and wealth managers being like, I love all this stuff so much, but there's no way to quote unquote make money from it. And I'm just done with that. I'm done with pretending there's an easy investment angle from any of these ideas. But what I can promise you is that there's massive material improvements in your own life that might then, like, it's not inconsistent with making a bunch of money. It's just not guaranteed.
Yeah. But it's courage. You know, we were talking just before I pressed the record button, to hope I did press the record button. But well, first of all, I mean, David Einhorn is the worst speaker on earth. Does he still read a prepared text? It's like, dude, like, why are you here? Just send me the email, you know? Like, and it's my original hedge fund benefactor, the guy who put up, you know, the initial seed capital, wonderful chap. He'd seeded Soros. Mm. And I was walking in his garden in Lugano, and he said to me, I think he had three reservations. I'm like, wow, only three? I'm like, this feels good. And one was my age, because I think I was early 30s. I was 33. And he was saying how George had been 40, and that whole kind of Nassim Taleb thing, when he goes back and he talks about life assurance in Renaissance Italy, and how the 50-year-old got cheaper life assurance than the 21-year-old. And initially, what? But it's like, 21-year-old life was even more precarious or less complex,
less
integrated back then. Whereas the 50-year-old guy, the guy had form. The guy was, you know, triple A credit rated. So there was the age. And it was two problems. And the other reservation was that I spoke too well. And I have to say, I've had the great fortune to share stages with the gods, and they can't speak. And I've also thought, oh, what if I could just, can we swap a little bit, one versus the other? Shit, what was I going to, and then I like the fact that you were saying you're going to get deeper and more complex, but then you're using language which coincides with album covers from the Police, synchronicity. So, I mean, we can stay in that loop. It's funny, my Zenyatta Mondatta, which I think I was 12, 13 when that came out. And I, you know, it was the long album, you know, I played it all the time on the gramophone. And it was recorded like 50 kilometers from where I am. And one of the tracks is Voices in My Head. And I'd forgotten all about this when I was writing my book. And I was kind of going through like the music of the time. And you know, the blissfulness that I've had has been, I hear voices in my head. Oh no, it's zim, zim, zoom, zoom time. It's the evil acid capitalist time. Friends, family, thank you for watching the first half an hour. I'm afraid the rest is behind the dreaded, the evil paywall. It's exclusively for lovely folks on Patreon and Substack. We do hope you can find us on the other side. We really hope we whetted your appetite. Peace and love from St. Bart's, from the Acid Capitalist.